we know what makes us healthy, and it isn't healthcare. Healthcare repairs damage done, but damage comes from elsewhere.
Welcome to Off the Chart, a business and medicine podcast featuring lively and informative conversations with healthcare experts, opinion leaders, and practicing physicians about the challenges facing doctors and medical practices. My name is Austin Luttrell. I'm the assistant editor of Medical Economics, and I'd like to thank you for joining us today. In this episode, Medical Economics senior editor Richard Peyerton sits down with Dr. Donald Berwick, president emeritus and senior fellow at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, and the former administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, to talk about the state of medical research. They'll also be talking about a National Academies of Medicine report that he co-authored on making sure that medical research dollars match up with the diseases and patient needs that matter most. Dr. Berwick is also host of IHI's Turn the Lights On podcast alongside former Off the Chart guest Dr. Kedar Mate. You can find their show linked in the description down below. You can also find the report that they'll be discussing, so you can give it a look for yourself. Dr. Berwick, thank you again for joining us, and now let's get into the episode.
Dr. Berwick, thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Richard. Thank you for having me.
And today we're going to talk about the state of American medical research and a new report by the National Academy of Medicine. Before we get to that, can you introduce yourself with a little bit about your education and experience?
Sure. Thank you, Richard. Well, I'm Don Berwick. I'm a pediatrician by training. Early on, got interested in quality of care, and with some colleagues started a nonprofit institute, the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, IHI. And your listeners can tune in and find it at IHI.org. It's now a global organization that tries to work on improving healthcare all over the world through using modern improvement methods and supporting clinicians and managers. I had a stint after that working in the Obama administration. I was the head of Medicare and Medicaid, the administrator of CMS for a year and a half, 17 months, and then returned to Massachusetts, where I live, as a senior fellow and president emeritus at IHI, the institute that I founded. I also do quite a bit of teaching around the world and still stay pretty focused on quality of care.
Excellent. And as I mentioned, we're here to discuss the new report, Aligning Investments in Therapeutic Development with Therapeutic Need, published by the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. Just as by way of introduction, can you explain how did this report come about?
There was a series of meetings going on around the country on this question: are we putting the money where it's needed support of development of new drugs and therapies, or is there a mismatch? Eventually, that was picked up by Gates Ventures and the Peterson Foundation, Arnold Ventures, I mean, and they approached the National Academy and offered to fund an independent study of that question.
And the committee came up with recommendations organized around five goals. Can you explain a little bit about what those are?
Yeah, we had a wonderful committee, and about 16 people from many walks of life, including both the investor community and drug developers themselves, academicians, experts on law and regulation. So we had the goal of trying to find out first what is the disease burden in the United States. Where are people really suffering? What conditions, and what portion of that burden is unmet? The needs are unmet in the sense that there is still no effective or limited effective medications or treatments for those diseases. We tried to find out the degree of match, mismatch, or match between the investments that are going on in both the public sector, such as NIH, and the private sector in drug developers and investors, where the investment's going, where the need really appeared to be. And to the extent we discovered and could document that mismatch, why? Why is it there? What is causing us to be off-center to that degree in therapeutic development? And then importantly, to develop a series of recommendations for policy, finance, public action to try to close the most important mismatches.
As of year 2025, sometimes it feels like, whether it be about medical topics, healthcare, or any subject matter, sometimes it feels like we have information overload. And yet the committee noted that there was a lack of data needed to produce a comprehensive evaluation to really fully address that mismatch. There were some therapeutic areas of underinvestment that were identified. Can you explain
Indeed.
how you identified those?
Well, we had to milk the available public data to discover where mismatches and matches were. I think you began, though, with the most important committee finding of all, which is we really don't know. We're flying blind. We don't have publicly accessible pedigree data on the either the disease burden in the country. Which is a big surprise to me. I thought we would have tons of data. And even more, it's hard to track down where the funding is going. It's a little more transparent with public funding, such as the National Institutes of Health. But on the private side, there really is very little opportunity of aggregating information on where the funding is going. So all of the conclusions we come up with thereafter are kind of like inhibited by this fundamental lack of data. And our first and most important recommendation is that there should be established by Congress an interagency consortium in the Department of Health and Human Services in an appropriate agency, which has the charge of tracking and assessing unmet therapeutic need associated with the burden of disease in the U.S., and also tracking current investments in innovation to identify areas of mismatch. In other words, there should be a standing body which can carry out the tasks that our committee was assigned. Without that information, it's going to be very tough to make sure that we have the alignment we're after.
I definitely want to get into some of those conditions because, we're talking about actual patients and a real human cost when people are
You bet.
dealing with illness and disease. But maybe to elaborate a little bit more on that point, there was the recommendation regarding establishing an interagency consortium to track those unmet therapeutic needs, research investments, and disease burden. Can you explain more about how that would work?
We envision a function within the Department of Health and Human Services. It's not clear, as the Trump administration is changing the configuration of HHS, exactly where that would land. But there should be, under the Secretary of HHS's guidance, a group that pulls together, especially the federal side of expertise from CDC, NIH, and other federal agencies that have knowledge about disease burden. And also with private sector participation, so we can aggregate the information in one place and most importantly, make it accessible to potential investors, to the public that has an interest in where the resources are going. Right now, there's no such aggregation and very little transparency, especially on the private investment side. We recommend that there be actually a report issued by this consortium on every 3 years on a 3 year basis, so we can track what the needs are, how they're evolving, and what the investments are, and how they're evolving.
In the United States, why is there such a misalignment between research investment and alignment with the disease burden and unmet need? How did that happen and why did that grow?
There's probably two big categories of reasons. On the one hand, science, missing science that allows the drug developers to get to work to find the molecules that will help combat disease. Second, markets and market forces, the economics of this, and both do matter. Especially recently, with what are, in my view, the very, very unfortunate cuts in our investments through the National Institutes of Health, through the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and others. These are extremely important investments in developing the underlying platform sciences that allow biomedical developments to occur for therapies. There are numerous areas of gap in those investments now, and they're getting worse with the current trend in policy. Sometimes it's just that they're difficult scientific issues that we have to put a lot of research work into, and that's really important to understand that the basic sciences that underlie the development of drugs, there's some uncertainty. You can't really know right at the start that a particular basic science investment is going to lead to a drug, but if you don't take the risks, you don't get the medications. There are also, with the modern AI world, some opportunities now on the research side to aggregate information and then digest it so that artificial intelligence can help us triangulate and find the areas that we should be investing in and the possible new therapies. On the market side, right now a lot of drug development is in the private sector, of course, and they look at return on investment. They want to see that the investments that they put in are within their capacities, and that where necessary, where the drugs to be developed won't pay off economically, that there be forms of subsidy and support to allow them nonetheless, the private sector nonetheless, to invest in innovations. And there can be misalignment at that level because, for example, it may be the case that the pricing strategies for drugs to acquire to be acquired can lead to anomalies in pricing where either the prices are too high for people to have access to those drugs, or in a very interesting subset of cases where there are very important disease burdens, where there exist a lot of generic drugs and low-cost drugs right now, the incentive to develop the frontier of such research can be very low because there's too much generic competition. That, of course, means that if we want to have drugs for which there's not a sufficient market case, then we need government intervention to make the market case more attractive.
Say, Keith, this is all well and good, but what if someone is looking for more clinical information?
Oh, then they want to check out our sister site, patientcareonline.com, the leading clinical resource for primary care physicians. Again, that's patientcareonline.com.
It may seem in our conversation we're bouncing back and forth between the science and some of those financial forces, and yet this is one of those instances where they're so uniquely intertwined that, again, I think this is really great food for thought and hopefully will translate into actual policy going forward. And when we talk about that financial element, the report underscores the role of Medicare and CMS as a powerful potential influence on therapeutic development. Can you explain why that financial element of CMS coverage, reimbursement, and drug price negotiations is so important?
Yes. Well, on the public side, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services is one of the largest purchasers of medications in the world. And the prices that they can set for purchase of medication have enormous effect on where drug producers and developers put their energies. Recently, with the expansion under the Inflation Reduction Act, CMS has acquired new authorities to negotiate drug prices that it never had before. Now the question is, how will CMS use those authorities? Right now, the main application has been to very high volume drugs, drugs which are costing CMS a lot of money. But in an ideal world, you might think that this consortium idea that we have of actually having data on unmet need could be translated by CMS into extra payment for drugs which would close those unmet need gaps. So CMS could become an instrument for drawing attention both of the public sector but also private sector into where they're putting the money for drug development simply by adjusting their pricing frames in accordance to the unmet need.
And to maybe continue along the lines of thinking about the federal government's role, you know, in the scientific research here, there always has to be a balance among patient safety, research, medical effectiveness, and the ability to bring new medicines to market. The report recommends the Food and Drug Administration maintain and uphold strong regulatory approval standards. How could the FDA realign research, you know, based on disease burden, needed treatments and cures, and unmet need?
Great question. Let me go back to a point that I think is crucial, and this is me speaking, not the committee. The current trend to decrease investments in research and development at the Food and Drug Administration and NIH is going to be very toxic to the goals we have as a country. We are talking about draconian cuts in the National Institutes of Health, which fund and also intramurally produce research that becomes the basis for drug development. So I'm extremely worried about what's happening now with funding of these agencies. It's a very big backward step in drug development. The Food and Drug Administration is interesting, absolutely a key agency. And it has, when I went into this project, not being an expert in this field, I expected that we would discover that the F Food and Drug Administration is actually a one, that failures at the FDA explain some of the gaps in new drug development. That didn't turn out to be the case. The more we looked at the FDA, I'll say, the more I impressed I was on the committee as a whole, at how diligent and expert FDA is in carrying out its tasks. Again, that will depend on ongoing FDA funding, which is very much at risk right now, but it's an agency that's done overall a very good job. Now, they, like we, are aware of gaps, both because of missing science and market forces. And they have mechanisms in the FDA to accelerate the approval of a drugs, accelerated approval in different forms. We came down as a committee saying that we need that. There have to be ways to fast track drugs with due diligence to the evidence base. But in the accelerated approval world, the FDA relaxes somewhat the standards for approval. For example, instead of requiring studies that show the ultimate outcome of treatment, they sometimes allow the use of surrogate measures or intermediate measures, which may or may not actually be related to the long-term fate. But when we're talking about diseases for which there are no treatments, or populations that are kind of left high and dry with no drugs, it makes sense to us for the FDA to have these accelerated approval mechanisms subject to a condition. And that's what you were talking about. So the way this works now is the FDA can say to a drug developer, yeah, that's really badly needed. There's a population with no treatment now. Subject to these somewhat relaxed standards of approval, you can go ahead and we'll approve the drug conditionally. Condition on post-marketing confirmatory studies, which do restore the full burden of proof with better design research, larger sample sizes, and true outcome measures. So for now, you can market the drug, but there have to be ongoing confirmatory studies underway. And should those confirmatory studies not confirm the safety and efficacy of the drug, then that drug will be withdrawn from the market. That's the condition now. However, it turns out it's more honored in the breach. A lot of confirmatory studies are never done. There are even drugs in which there are confirmatory studies which show the drug to be ineffective or unsafe, and then the drug is not withdrawn from the market. This has to do with capacities within the FDA. And so our recommendations are that the FDA reinvest in the use of these accelerated approval subsequent confirmatory studies with much more diligence than it's been able to muster so far. Again, that will take extra resources in the FDA at a time when the administration is cutting back on FDA personnel and funding, and so that's another kind of mismatch. We think that correctly implemented, this accelerated approval with confirmatory studies is safe enough that the public can be assured that their long-run interests are being protected.
No, that is something that, whether it be a physician or patient perspective, obviously, if a drug is ineffective, I mean, let's face it, that can be a waste of time and money. And if it's harmful, then goodness gracious, I mean, you don't necessarily even want that going out in the first place. So that is just vitally important, I would think.
Yeah, you can understand some patients' point of view, which would be, I have a disease, it's fatal, or it's going to hurt me badly. There's no treatment now, and here's a treatment that might work. Please let that drug get to market in a way that I can start to use it, even while the confirmatory studies are underway. That makes some sense, as long as there's real serious commitment to the science in the longer run.
We've talked quite a bit about the role of some of those federal agencies that could, that they could have in correcting the misalignment here between unmet need and research. How do you see the role of private funders evolving in the effort to realign medical research with disease burden?
Well, two or three ways. First, remember the earlier assertion, we're kind of flying blind. We don't have a public database showing us the disease burden and the degree of gaps that anyone can access so that they can decide what to buy, what to invest in, whether they be a member of Congress or a private investor. So this idea, recommendation number one, about a publicly available database that dealing with disease burden and unmet needs and current levels of investment, I think it's essential. That may mean new level of transparency on the private sector side, who want to protect their intellectual property, of course. But I think we feel we'll all be better off if the data are made available, at least in aggregated form, so that we can look at gaps. That those gaps will become a business opportunities for organizations once they're aware of it, that they can move into it, we don't have now. It's very difficult to do that. There are, by the way, an interesting subset of medications where particular drug companies develop a medicine that would be effective if brought to market, but that medicine doesn't fit that drug company's business model. And so it remains on the shelf, an intellectual asset, a molecule or a promising molecule that remains on the shelf. Part of the policy changes that could be made would be to have better mechanisms to get those off the shelf and into other hands so that they can be developed to help the people that could benefit from those medications. I think the willingness of the drug developers to participate in this level of transparency would be a big asset if we could pull that forward into the models for the future. Also, remember that a lot of drug developers are following up on public investments. They're using knowledge gained by, say, the National Institutes of Health to then develop the drugs that they can make money on. So, you know, there's a bit of a, what should I call it, a kind of agreement here that I think we need as a matter of social policy, which is when our public dollars are being put in developing the basic sciences upon which drugs will be developed, we, the public, own part of that asset and can make some rules about how that asset can be used. The other theme in the report that's pretty big is public-private partnerships. It's not possible to put all of the burden for this entire trajectory of addressing unmet need, doing the basic science, and bringing a drug to market on the government. Government is a player, a crucial player, but we need better and stronger relationships between the government and private investors and private developers in public-private partnerships, which again can be guided by the priorities that could be developed with a better database.
Hey there, Keith Reynolds here, and welcome to the P2 Management Minute. In just 60 seconds, we deliver proven, real-world tactics you can plug into your practice today, whether that means speeding up check-in, lifting staff morale, or nudging patient satisfaction north. No theory, no fluff, just the kind of guidance that fits between appointments and moves the needle before lunch. But the best ideas don't all come from our newsroom. They come from you. Got a clever workflow hack, an employee engagement win, or a lesson learned the hard way? I want to feature it. Shoot me an email at kreynolds@mjhlifesciences.com with your topic, quick outline, or even a smartphone clip. We'll handle the rest and get your insights in front of your peers nationwide. Let's make every minute count together. Thanks for watching, and I'll see you in the next P2 Management Minute.
I'm curious about your perspective because some primary care physicians, we know their situation. They're swamped. They are treating some of the conditions that are chronic conditions that are a huge disease burden in the United States. And some of them might look at a study like this and say, okay, well, that's great for the pharmaceuticals, the drug companies, the doctors and researchers who are working in academia. Can you discuss maybe some of those connections and conditions in primary care and how this research actually translates to medicine out there going on in exam rooms or even right now?
Well, I'm a primary care doctor, practiced for 20 years in general pediatrics. And like I think all doctors, nurses, clinicians, I want to be able to offer my patients drugs that can help them, medications that really do work and that are affordable for them. And see, we haven't talked much about affordability. So I think the primary care voice here is really important to insist that the research and the developments are going where the patients I see need them to go. It borders a little bit on political comments, but we really do need outspoken physician communities, beginning with primary care, insisting that the use of science today is the necessary foundation for the development of therapeutics of the future. I also think there are probably even more opportunities in the future for primary care physicians to participate in consortia for research and development of drugs in the public sector by becoming participants in research projects and others that can benefit their patients. So both as potential beneficiaries of drug development and potential drivers of drug development, primary care can play a very big role here. Right now, the concerns I've expressed several times in this interview about what I believe to be, this is me personally speaking, extremely unwise cutbacks in our investment in research and development in NIH and FDA and elsewhere, that's something I think the physician community should be standing up loud and clear about and saying, absolutely not. Science is the foundation of good care, and we insist that science be supported fully and expanded in some cases.
I'm going from memory, and to be perfectly candid, I don't remember every page of a 245-page report, so I just don't remember.
You're making me feel better with that. Thank you.
You know what? And where I'm going with that is, I just don't remember if it explicitly did mention about the efforts to make America healthy again, and the leadership of HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. How do you want the report to contribute to the new national conversation about making America healthy again?
Well, at a specific level, there is information in the report that you've referred to, which shows some areas where we do appear to be underinvested. And for example, if you look at public sector investment, chronic lung disease, low back pain, ischemic heart disease, very, very common burdens, these don't have investment in public research at the level that you'd think they would if you look at overall disease burden. The reasons are complicated, but I think Congress, I think, needs to take under advisement where the gaps appear to be, and so should the agencies, the federal agencies. Right now, the across-the-board cuts that are occurring in NIH are going in the wrong direction. So there is some detail in the report on particular conditions that probably deserve more attention now. If you look at the private sector, remember that private investment is more difficult to track than public investment, but there are some hints that we are underinvesting in maternal and neonatal disorders and treatments of those, nutritional deficiencies, substance abuse disorders, mental disorders in general, very high burden conditions where the investments in the private sector don't appear commensurate. There is an interesting subcategory we've mentioned before that I'll highlight also again, which is that for some really common diseases like cardiovascular disorders or hypertension, the current drugs available are now commoditized. They're generics, and that decreases the willingness of the private sector to invest. And if in its wisdom, Congress and the administration say, no, we ought to be investing, hypertension is still the biggest killer among us in many ways, we're going to have to put money behind that so that it can become interesting for new drug development. In terms of where things are now, again, speaking for myself, I'm extremely concerned about the administration and the HHS secretary contravening science, being willing to support things that are not scientifically validated, and decreasing investment and trust in really important areas of development, for example, vaccines. So I guess I have to say, Richard, I'm really worried right now about the direction that things are going. And I'm speaking for myself now, not for the committee. Let's make that really clear. We know what makes us healthy, and it isn't healthcare. Healthcare repairs damage done, but damage comes from elsewhere. So if we really wanted to make America healthy again, we would be putting extensive resources where other countries often do that have much longer life expectancy than we do, for example, into things like early childhood education and development, safe birthing. Things like education, our schools, that's the source of health as young people get educated and acquire talent and self-confidence, workplace protections, strong unions, adequate minimum wage structures, reaching out to the elderly so that people who are lonely in their older years have company and there are community-based resources to help them, safe communities, communities that work on food security, housing security, communities that work on environmental protections. The biggest threat to human health on the planet now, according to the World Health Organization, is climate change and global warming. Well, unfortunately, as you look at those determinants of health, early childhood, schools, workplaces, elder care, community resources, this administration's going backwards in the total policy. So it's not in this case drug policy or medical policy we're talking about. It's the total package of policies. And we are backing away as a country from investing in the things that actually would make us healthy. We need two things. We need health care when we need it, including medications. But we also need investments in health production. And that's important for the public to understand. We're going the wrong direction right now.
This is a question, frankly, I think like literally every interview now we ask about Make America Healthy Again. And then the other question that we ask for every interview is how AI might get involved. And interest in artificial intelligence and large language model programs has really taken off in the last few years. How do you think these new technologies could be used either in medical research that's needed to fill unmet needs or maybe determining the greatest areas of need for more study?
With respect to artificial intelligence, I'm kind of bullish on it. I actually think there's some real promise here in the area of therapeutic development. The use of AI, including generative AI, with very large databases can produce findings and results that no human mind could ever discover. And we, in the course of our committee's work, we heard testimony from people from the oncology community, from a rare disease community, and others that show that we have adequate, large, privacy-protected databases. AI can point out things and discover things we never could have known before. This is independent of AI's opportunity to help me as a doctor make better choices, because I can't read all the medical literature, 30 or 40,000 randomized trials a year. Can't read them, but AI can. And so I think the potential here for bringing artificial intelligence to bear on priorities, on new relationships that could lead to therapies, and supporting decision-making at the bedside, I think all is very, very promising.
Just wanted to ask sort of an open-ended question, if there were any points that we didn't talk about yet that you'd really like to bring to the table.
Yeah, I don't want to, again, get too technical, but there's a very important part of this report. So when people open this report, they expect to see the list of things we should invest in but aren't. And there are some of those. I've mentioned some, and you can find that in the report. But no, we did not really swing the bat the whole way saying, okay, America, here's the 10 diseases we should be investing in. The reason is a complex one. It has to do with values and value structure. For example, there are a lot of rare, very, very serious diseases for which, you know, the number of people that actually have them are measured in the hundreds or thousands, not the millions. If you simply take a utilitarian view and say, well, we're just going to maximize the disability-adjusted life years, then you don't put money into rare diseases. That doesn't sound right to me. People with rare diseases need a shot at cures being found for them, too. So this is a value judgment. And if you read our report carefully, you'll see we're opening the questions of what are the values that you want to see expressed in new drug development beyond, you know, some simple blunt calculation of years of life saved or lost. So there's some subtleties here about the kind of country we want to be. Do you want to be a country in which if you have a rare disease, this nation is still behind you and still going to invest in finding cures where cures are lacking? My answer is yes, but it's a public policy issue that needs to be addressed.
Our main audience is primary care physicians. You are one yourself. What would you like to say to them, or what would you like them to know?
I say thank you. Primary care is every successful health system I know in the world, and I've traveled all over the world, is fundamentally founded on its primary care system, which isn't necessarily just doctors. There are many others that help in the primary care world. So first, thank you. Keep at it and encourage others to keep at it. But I think my main message overall has got to be now speak up for science, speak up for supports to the dedicated federal agencies that provide the foundational support and the resources through which we can discover the drugs that are yet undiscovered and find the biomedical mechanisms that we have to use as foundational for further drug discovery. If the medical community stays silent, bad things will happen, and they are happening now. So I guess my plea for the primary care community is speak up, speak up. You need your voice more than ever before.
That's a great message. And again, I've just really enjoyed our conversation. Dr. Berwick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Once again, that was a conversation between Medical Economics Senior Editor Richard Perrichin and Dr. Donald Berwick, President Emeritus and Senior Fellow at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement and former Administrator of CMS. My name is Austin Luttrell, and on behalf of the whole Medical Economics and Physicians Practice teams, I'd like to thank you for listening to the show and ask that you please subscribe so you don't miss the next episode. Be sure to check back on Monday and Thursday mornings for the latest conversations with experts sharing strategies, stories, and solutions for your practice. You can find us by searching Off the Chart wherever you get your podcasts. Also, if you'd like the best stories that Medical Economics and Physicians Practice publish delivered straight to your email 6 days of the week, subscribe to our newsletters at medicaleconomics.com and physicianspractice.com. Off the Chart, a Business and Medicine podcast, is executive produced by Chris Mazzolini and Keith Reynolds and produced by Austin Luttrell. Medical Economics, Physicians Practice, and Patient Care Online are all members of the MJH Life Sciences family. Thank you.